Yes, and I'm not going to present that today, but I can talk to you about it because it's being published and reported in other areas. Yeah.
Great. Okay, we're staying right on time. Thank you very much, Janet. Next speaker is Jerry Vincent, who will speak on appropriate guidelines for eye care in complex humanitarian emergencies and disasters. Dr. Vincent.
Thank you. Okay, first thing you might wonder, complex humanitarian emergencies and disasters, very brief explanation. We kind of divide crisis sort of things into complex humanitarian emergencies, which are largely resulting from war or conflict, and disasters kind of generically to represent natural disasters. There's actually a lot of overlap, and not everything is that clear-cut, but just in terms of the terminology there. I do work for International Rescue Committee. We are a humanitarian organization that works specifically with these populations. No commercial relationships to disclose. Okay, you might think that this is a very particular, almost arcane thing, and why should we, you know, worry about guidelines for such a small segment of the population? But just to give you a little idea about the scale and scope of this, at any given time, there's 20 to 40 conflicts going on. And year by year, the numbers go up and down, but at the end of 2007, we had 40 million refugees and displaced people around the world. That's the size of the population of Argentina. So you have a large population out there who are fleeing because of conflict. Numbers to get to people who can't flee but are affected by conflict are a lot harder to come by, but it's probably in the neighborhood of 200 to 300 million people. So in terms of complex humanitarian emergencies, this does impact a lot of people. In terms of natural disasters, year by year, for the past few decades, the number of people affected by natural disasters has gone up quite a bit as well. So we're actually talking about large numbers of populations. Natural disasters and numbers going up, yeah, the population is growing, but the number of natural disasters is increasing year by year, as well as the severity. Some of this is global warming, and it's particular maybe more to cyclones and other sorts of things. So we're actually having a big impact on pretty large pieces of the population. In terms of the money, this is a multi-billion dollar industry, and I'll use the word industry. Probably now over $10 billion a year is spent on assistance to emergency affected populations. So we're talking about a large number of people across a lot of countries with huge budgets involved. Humanitarian response is actually now a profession. You might think, well, this is something, okay, everybody gung-ho, we need a lot of volunteers to go out and help people. But over the past two decades in particular, this has really developed a lot. There's a jargon and terminology, graduate courses, a lot of professors who specialize in researching this sort of thing, textbooks and journals, UN bodies and NGOs, such as the one I work for, who specialize in these populations and these things, and there's sort of an ethos around this industry involved with that. This field is very public health oriented, very driven by data and evidence-based decision making, and has very much a standard of do no harm. And we might think that applies throughout all of healthcare, and it does, but it isn't a matter quite so much of you give the wrong medicine, it can harm somebody, but just even providing aid to a population where you think you're doing good and saving lives, you might now be freeing up the leaders of this population to now spend money on arms and to continue a conflict and so on. So you think you're doing good and you might actually be contributing to a larger problem. There's a lot of fallacies and myths that go around this. I'm just going to touch on a few for a minute. Most of these are related to disasters, but sometimes the people who are worst about believing these are the medical professionals. Some of these are that epidemics and plagues are inevitable after a disaster or an emergency, that dead bodies pose a health risk and you have to dispose of them immediately, that any kind of international assistance is needed right now, and in particular, healthcare providers. We need to get as many foreign volunteers as we can right away. That disasters are kind of random killers, and that things do get back to normal in a few weeks. Actually, all of these are false. So there is a lot of misconceptions, and a lot of people have the wrong idea, and again, healthcare professionals in particular. One of my favorite sayings in this entire industry, if you will, is don't just do something, stand there and count. One of the most critical elements in responding to disasters or emergencies is getting an appropriate baseline assessment to know what you're up against and to plan accordingly. The basic needs that are almost always there, particular water and sanitation, food and nutrition, disease control, shelter and clothing. A lot of people think it might have to do more with injuries and rescuing people right away. That's usually done in the first few hours, and it's not something that foreign assistance or large NGOs are actually involved with much. There's a lot of phases to emergencies and disasters. Acute phase is the initial phase right away where a lot of people, or excess number of people, are dying. This can go on into protracted or chronic emergencies, such as you have a conflict area, South Sudan, Congo, places like that. Reconstruction, rehabilitation phases, warehouse populations where refugees are in camps and they'll be there for maybe 10 years or 20 years or 30 years. There's 8 million people who've been in camps at least 10 years around the world right now. Resettlement or reintegration when people can actually start going back. It's a little bit difficult to work in these environments. People on the move, just getting a handle on how many there are, where they're at. A lot of security concerns, especially when you're dealing with conflict zones. And often the infrastructure is really bad. You're either in a very remote place of a poor country, or perhaps the infrastructure has been destroyed by disaster. So there's a lot of operational considerations that make it a bit difficult as well. What we have as the law, or the Bible, or the rule book, if you will, is something called the SPHERE guidelines. And this is available online. It's available in several languages. This is for the health response in disasters and emergencies. So you can write this down. It's sphereproject.org. Very easy to find. A lot of languages. And this provides minimum standards for responding to emergencies for water and sanitation, food security, nutrition and food aid, health services, shelter, settlement and non-food items. This is what everyone signs off on. The process of creating this document has taken well over 10 years, and it's in its second generation now. It was initially based on the best available scientific evidence. There's a lot of things there where there wasn't a lot of hard evidence or peer-reviewed information available, so a process of consensus involving thousands of people in several countries and several universities going through to distill this into guidelines for providing response. There's some common standards to each of those areas about participation, initial assessment. I won't read the list, but all of these are considered in each of the areas for water, health, sanitation, and so on. And just to take a look at the health services section, each one is broken down into two or three or four or five categories and a list under that, and each of these numbered items has measurable indicators of what you're supposed to meet when you're addressing a humanitarian response. None of this mentions eye care specifically at all, but no particular specialty is mentioned in any of this. This is a very generic sort of document. But anything involving eye care must be compliant with these standards when they're there. There is also mention of very specific populations, which are often more vulnerable: children, older people, disabled, gender issues, HIV, and so on. One of the weaknesses of this document is it works very, very well in the acute part of the response, when death rates are high and you're just trying to save lives. It starts to break down a little bit when you're working with chronic problems or you're working with warehoused populations, because at that point you need to start addressing chronic diseases and disabilities. You need to start addressing things like eye problems. And it's not specifically spelled out, it's not specifically mentioned, so the guidance isn't really there. In particular with warehoused populations where the health status can be quite good, you've got a lot of things you need to work on. And it's a problem with donors. You're working with the population, you've met the basic standards for saving lives, people aren't dying of cholera, they have enough water to drink in terms of surviving, and the donors just say, we don't need to give you more money, you've already met the standard. But that standard is just supposed to keep people alive. It's not supposed to allow people to thrive or actually do well. So there's some weaknesses with this document, and I did something wrong there. Okay. So again, based on evidence, we don't have a lot of data about eye problems in these populations, but we can extrapolate. Just looking at the 40 million people who are refugees and displaced, using the WHO data by region, we know that probably over 300,000 of them would be blind. Several hundred thousand would be visually impaired. This doesn't include refractive error at all. Refractive error isn't looked at in terms of prevalence, but it's looked at in terms of uncorrected refractive error. Our experience with these populations is they're in poor countries, in rural areas, that almost nobody's corrected. So looking at demographics, we probably have 5 or 6 million people in this particular crowd who would also need eyeglasses as well. Because of the type of populations there are, we know that there's going to be some special problems as well, particularly around conflict, landmine victims, and people who have other difficulties because of the conflict will add to those numbers, and the severity of illnesses and things that lead to blindness and vision impairment is a lot worse. And we have data from very specific locations to know that the initial estimates that we had from WHO are going to be minimum. They'll actually be a lot worse. What we know enough now to recommend for everyone is that eye care is not indicated in the acute phase of the emergency response. You don't want to do things when we're trying to save lives. Oftentimes, what we call a humanitarian field, the ability to move around and get in and out of an area is very difficult. Very difficult to move supplies in and out. The number of people who can get in because of security issues and so on is quite limited. And if it's all about getting initial food in, getting initial water in, you don't want to be trying to do things such as eye care or other things that, which can be held off till later on. You need to provide a rationale for responding. You don't want to think, gee, I want to go over and help people. That looks really bad on television. A very sound rationale about why you're going, it needs to be based on some sort of evidence for whatever intervention that you want to take. Everything needs to be integrated into the primary health care system. It's really awkward. Often people come in with some special issue and set up a separate program over here, and everybody else is very well coordinated, working together, and if you're not part of the coordination, it really sort of mucks things up. The eye agencies who work internationally, none of them really have experience in this sort of field. And at least for now, for eye interventions, they need to be partnering with the agencies who do this. And then we can provide a lot of coverage for those. We're taking the SPHERE guidelines. We're going through them step by step to look at everywhere we can comment on eye programs, eye problems, and how eye interventions might apply. We're going through the SPHERE process to get this approved, and we're also going to Vision 2020. The WHO IAPB International Initiative to Eliminate Blindness Worldwide, and we're getting approval from Vision 2020 as well. So we're going to get approval from both sides, the emergency sector and the eye sector, for guidelines that will be eye-specific. And with that, we hope not only will it be guidance for people who want to respond to these sort of things, but just the process of doing this, we're going to create a lot of awareness that we really have a lot of populations out there that have specific needs, and that maybe this awareness will lead to some action with others. Synergy with other sort of sectors. It isn't just eyes. A lot of people working in anything to do with chronic diseases and disabilities are feeling that there isn't enough guidance about how to respond to emergencies. It's not specifically spelled out. So working with other people will be stronger in terms of advocating for providing care, and we hope that that will all lead to increased coverage in these populations. Again, there's about 40 million refugees and displaced, 200 or 300 million conflict-affected populations. The disaster number is really low. It's probably much higher than that, but that's a lot of people. We know that very few of them have eye care right now. Coverage is probably 5%. Or 10% in this population. Vision 2020, the right to sight, is actually the right to sight to everybody. And step by step, we hope to get some coverage in these populations. I'm happy to answer any questions. And yep.
Describe how you actually operationalize the eye care services at the post-acute phase, and
yeah,
recovery and rehabilitation phase.
Yes, it's this is going to sound contradictory, but a lot of it's very specific activities, almost a vertical activity. For example, you're addressing trachoma in this population because you have data that there's high prevalence of trachoma. So that particular activity is providing Zithromax once a year to the entire population and working on health education to reduce the rates of trachoma infection, for example. Very rarely is it coming in and setting up a comprehensive eye service. It's hard to justify that. But you can justify, you have high rates that you've proven for trachoma, for river blindness, for vitamin A deficiency, to do public health interventions. For sight restoration, we're looking primarily at two things. One is providing eyeglasses. That'll be done real simple, spherical equivalent lenses with locally trained people to do simple refractions to give those out, and cataract surgery. It gets a little bit strange because you're in poor countries who don't have a lot of cataract surgery capacity anyway. You want to provide it to a very specific segment of the population, and it's not from that country. So you can't spend a lot of money to exceed what the local people get. There's a lot of balances that have to be there as well. Yeah, vision outcomes. If it's sight restoration, we look at vision outcomes. Yeah, visual acuity outcomes. Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you give a pair of eyeglasses, you got the outcome right there. If you do surgery, it's something you need to measure 4 or 6 weeks later. So we monitor vision outcomes for anything that's sight restoration. If it's preventing blindness, it's the prevalence of that underlying disease. So the prevalence of trachoma infection here, and then after interventions, you want it to be at an acceptable level.
I guess there would be some basic differences between the conditions in the conflict-affected areas and disaster-affected
areas
in terms of providing eye care. So when you talk about the guidelines and involving international agencies, how do you differentiate the difference?
Okay, I'll speak to that very generically. There is, and it's not spelled out in the larger document because it needs to apply to both, but there really are two different things, and we use different terminologies with that. Responding to conflict, you're usually involving large agencies, UN bodies, and a lot of other things. And there you need a lot more sort of expertise with the context of working in conflict. Responding to disasters is often a very local thing. We have large disasters like the tsunami and so on, but mostly it's a mudslide that's local, or a tornado that's local, or a hurricane that affects maybe not such a large area. And there it's the local community who actually does most of the response. And in a place like the U.S., you have a lot of preparation for these sort of things and planning and so on. So for disasters, it's often very local, and just having some knowledge of what's the best way to do that. But being local is the best thing you can do, just knowing what's going on locally. Whereas conflict is, this applies a lot more. I don't know if I answered your question very well or not, but there are differences, yeah.
Thank you very much. Okay.